It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn about a proposal that would have Milwaukee be one of the first major cities to equip all beat cops with body cameras.
But first, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup.
Scott Walker made national news this week with his performance in the second Republican primary debate. We'll look at what's ahead for the governor. Also in the news, groups supporting Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson are set to ramp up spending on ads around Wisconsin.
We're joined now by USA Today reporter Donovan Slack, who's also covering Scott Walker's presidential campaign. Donovan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Governor Walker's debate performance. Now, overall, it seems as though he talked almost less, well, less than anybody else that night. What else are people saying?
I mean, it's really a slow drumbeat of bad news for Governor Walker this week. You are correct. He spoke less than anyone else at the debate, and his campaign has started to blame CNN, which hosted the debate, and, of course, the moderator, Jake Tapper. But there are other things to look at here, and one of them is time was given to candidates whose names were invoked. Therefore, no one else on the stage invoked Governor Walker's name as much as they did others, and that meant he got less time. But that also is a reflection of his low standing in the polls right now.
And what does that mean for his ability at this point to fundraise to keep his campaign afloat?
Well, this is exactly the point. While national polls and such may not matter because we elect a president state by state, what does matter is money. And the thinking here is that these bad or less than stellar debate performances could really affect his ability to raise money, as they do affect his standing in the polls.
Now, one way to look at this is that, you know, there are some people who are calling for a shakeup to his current team, maybe a sense of a change of direction. Other people, including guests on the show, saying if we see that, it's a sign of maybe the end for Governor Walker's campaign. How would you view any changes to his team that might be made?
Well, I think that's an important development, and some people could look at it as an important restart, an attempt to revive a campaign that is going downward. I don't know. It could also mean the end of his campaign if he doesn't switch gears. Some of his donors, as you mentioned, we spoke to one yesterday at USA Today, who said he's still sticking with Governor Walker, but he's actually going to spread the love around now. He's going to choose some other horses as well, and that's not a good sign for the governor.
We're going to move on to the race between Senator Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, former senator. The conservative group American Crossroads has said that Johnson needs to run a flawless campaign to win. What is the story there?
Right. Well, American Crossroads is the group you may remember that was co-founded by Karl Rove, and they have very deep pockets. And they haven't decided whether to spend outside money in the Johnson-Feingold race. But they do have a very astute view of politics, and it means something when they say that Senator Johnson has to run, quote, a flawless campaign to win, because few people run flawless campaigns.
Any idea about what the two strategies will be for both Johnson and Feingold going forward?
Well, clearly, campaign finance is going to be a central issue. It has already become an issue on both sides, with Russ Feingold trying to get Senator Johnson to sign the so-called Badger Pledge, which would, try to prohibit outside spending. But Russ Feingold himself has also benefited from outside spending from groups taking out negative ads against Johnson, and Johnson is not barring outside spending. He's going to need that outside spending because he's not going to self-fund this time. At least that's what he has pledged.
We're talking with Donovan Slack right now. He's with Gannett Wisconsin Media and is a politics reporter for USA Today. And we want to end with a look at how Wisconsin is reacting to recent Planned Parenthood videos compared with the rest of the nation. Now, state Republicans have introduced bills to ban fetal tissue research and to fund Planned Parenthood. How does that compare nationally?
Well, those videos have set off a firestorm, as you can tell, there in Wisconsin and here in Washington, D.C. Just today, the House of Representatives passed a measure that would defund Planned Parenthood, and it could actually bring our federal government to a shutdown again in a matter of weeks. We have a group of very vocal Republicans who do not want to pass any funding of the federal government unless that measure also includes defunding of Planned Parenthood. Of course, President Obama would veto any such measure, and that could bring the doors of our federal government once again shut. And that deadline is 12 days from now.
And now Wisconsin doesn't have a consensus in the state Senate to pass the fetal tissue bill. Is that a common problem nationally?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some Republicans want to force a government shutdown. Some Republicans don't. They say it's a losing cause. I see that the Senate Majority Leader early this week in Wisconsin signaled that he wants to get something through, and he's trying to work with the Assembly and, of course, Governor Walker to come up with something. It's interesting because each level is taking on the area that they have the jurisdiction over. On the state level, it's fetal tissue and its use in research, and, of course, on the national level, it's the actual federal funding. It remains to be seen which side is going to win out at this point on either level.
And what are you looking for in terms of moves on the board next on this issue?
Well, I think, you know, all eyes are going to be on whether there can be a compromise. You cannot discount the fact that Governor Scott Walker is also running for president. I have yet to see him weigh in, although he may have and I may have missed it, but I think he has to be part of that deal.
Donovan, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was USA Today reporter Donovan Slack taking us through some of the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will appeal to the Common Council to equip all Milwaukee beat cops with body cameras by the end of 2016 when he presents his budget on Monday. If approved, the plan would make Milwaukee one of the first major cities to fully equip a force with body cameras.
The question of whether officers should wear body cameras has been at the forefront of a national conversation about police use of force and the relationship between police and minority communities. Locally, protests followed the officer involved shooting of Dontre Hamilton in downtown Milwaukee, and more than 2,000 people signed a petition urging the police department to use body cameras.
While the cameras have support, others are concerned about privacy and that the cameras could be manipulated or seen as a cure-all. The plan does have the backing of Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, and he joins us now. Chief Flynn, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
Well, earlier this month, an advisory committee in Madison voted against implementing body cameras after talking to the community, worries about privacy, other things. There's been a national move in favor of body cams. Why do you come down on supporting equipping all the patrol officers there in Milwaukee with these body cameras?
Well, we came to the conclusion against the backdrop of the national conversation about transparency and accountability that there was a strong push from the general public that we employ these devices. We started looking into it more than a year ago and saw that it had some value, certainly from the officer's point of view. It was an opportunity for them to both get evidence as well as document their conduct. From the public's point of view, it was an ability to document the officer's conduct. And given the fact that we are basically living in a surveillance state right now, as everyone's got a cell phone with a video attachment, it only made sense that since officers are being generally recorded by the general public, that perhaps they record themselves. So in the interests of, as I say, both transparency and accountability, we thought this would be a good move.
How do the officers who would actually be wearing these cameras feel about it? What have you been hearing from them?
Generally, we've received positive feedback from the officers. I mean, they've got cameras in their patrol cars now already. They're certainly well aware of current events, and they recognize that, you know, as I say, they're constantly being surveilled themselves. And from their point of view, this offers them an opportunity to offer documentation of their activities that has not been edited by anyone, and that can I think, in the vast majority of circumstances, exonerate their behavior.
A lot of questions have come up about how these cameras are going to be used. One of the biggest is, when do officers have the camera on? When are they authorized or even required to turn it off? What are you looking at as far as that kind of policy?
Well, we have to recognize, I think we've got a solid policy that's based on the current state of practice, but we also recognize that this is an evolving technology, and it's an evolving set of circumstances, and we're not going to pretend to come out of the gate with the perfect policy. We suspect as time goes on and we have more and more experience with this locally as well as observe the national scene, there will probably have to be some modifications to the policy. But as of now, the officers are expected to have it on whenever they're engaging in an official police contact. And if they're going to a call, if they're handling a disturbance, if they are, you know, in a pursuit, you know, everything that's an official piece of business, they should record it. Now, we do give them some discretion to turn it off, but they have to so say on the cell phone recording and, body camera recording and say the reason why they're turning it off. So, for example, if they're handling a sexual assault case or they're interviewing a child or they're talking to an informant or an undercover officer or some other particularly sensitive rather than critical set of circumstances, we authorize them to turn it off. But as I say, they have to take responsibility for that act and explain it.
And are there situations where they are required to keep it on? They are not authorized to turn it off?
Well, when they're in the midst of handling some official police business, they're supposed to keep it on. And when that business is over, they're certainly allowed to turn it off when they're talking to their partner or driving around in their car or walking their beat. But if there's if there's any reason to believe that they're going to engage in an official act, they have to have it on.
Another question comes up with all of the data that's going to be collected here, firstly hundreds, then thousands of hours of footage from these cameras. How long does it get stored, archived? Will the public have access to it, the media, people in court cases?
Well, those are all good questions. We're going to keep it for 120 days unless it's flagged for evidence. We'd like to see that amount of time actually reduced because it is going to be very, very expensive to store all this data, notwithstanding that it'll be in the proverbial cloud. It's a lot of data, and the vast majority of it will be mundane and unexceptional. Right now we're going to hold to the 120-day requirement. As for the rest of your question, I have already forgotten it.
When will people have access from the public or the media to this kind of information, if at all?
Well, right now we're going to adhere to, our best interpretation with our legal counsel of the open records laws in Wisconsin. I think it's an important issue. When we first discussed this, there were a lot of demands, last year in the light of last year's events, we were still in the process of researching body cameras. And there were a lot of community demands that the police all have body cameras. And one of the first thing we said was, well, we're not going to object to it. We see some use. We're looking into it. But obviously, there are privacy concerns here. And in the clamor, and there's been a vast public clamor for body cameras, people need to recognize that we intervene in the most intimate and critical situations in people's lives. And now we're going to record it. And the question really is, are people going to have to sacrifice every single expectation of privacy in an encounter with the police? And how will public records deal with that? And are there perhaps amendments to the public records laws that might be considered in the light of the type of interventions we are routinely involved in? I think those are all critical, important questions, and I don't have the answers right now. I think it's, really intrusive, quite honestly, that all of these interactions theoretically could be an open record. You call the police and you could be on TV. I don't think that's in anybody's interest right now, unless it's a critical incident or it's evidentiary. But theoretically, that's that's where we are. So I think those are all questions that are going to have to be resolved as we move forward.
We're talking about police body cameras with Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn. Chief Flynn, you've said to the media in the past, hey, I support these things, but the public should not view them as a magic wand. Why not?
Well, there is a national conversation about the appropriate levels of police accountability and transparency. And the quick reaction, and this was pretty much nationwide, apparently except in Madison, was to demand that police officers have body cameras. Okay. And I said all along that, all right, I get it. It makes us transparent. It provides a level of accountability. It provides evidence. But having body cameras doesn't guarantee ethical policing. Having body cameras is not going to alter the harsh reality of urban policing, which is we are intervening in the most disadvantaged, devastated, dangerous neighborhoods in America. We are dealing with crisis after crisis, and we have an extraordinary problem in a number of our major cities, including Milwaukee, of young men of color from disadvantaged backgrounds murdering each other. That's our reality. Body cameras isn't going to change that. It may put some people's minds at ease that it'll affect our behavior. I certainly know it'll affect the behavior of people we encounter. I suspect that citizen complaints will go down because a large number of people, when they're told they're being recorded, will decide not to bother filing a complaint because they're being documented. I think it has as much or more impact on public conduct than on the officer conduct. But as I say, none of that's a magic wand. There are many things still to be resolved in terms of policing a free society against the backdrop of the challenges of crime. And those have to be ongoing conversations and ongoing relationship building, separate and apart from whatever technology we develop.
Well, with that wider conversation in mind, I understand that there are estimates that the cameras will cost something like $1 million a year, maybe about the cost of 12 additional officers, say. So while you think body cameras are a good idea, would you rather that money be spent in other ways, more officers, other technology?
I don't think, you know, there's a police chief right now in the country that can stand against the general public sentiment to fix body cameras to our officers. And recognizing that, and as I say, recognizing the fact that a wide variety of people want to record the activities of officers for their own purposes, edited or unedited, it's as much a self-defense as it is a evidentiary tool. So it's really not an either-or choice for me. This is something that's can produce valuable evidence. It's something that can provide a level of transparency and accountability that the current circumstances don't. And at the same time, it's responsive to, as I say, a wide coalition of parties who seem to believe that this is necessary to ensure appropriate police conduct.
But you've said a couple times now, this is a response to a public demand for this. If you could make your case to the public, what would you like there to be? What would you like to see change in policing? What do you want the public to know about your needs as a police chief?
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to my needs as a police chief, it's really, I'm more concerned about what the needs of the community are right now. And we police an array of communities. Every city is a city of neighborhoods. Every neighborhood has different needs and desires and concerns about the level of police protection they receive. The one thing I know is that every neighborhood wants more. Doesn't matter if it's advantaged or disadvantaged. It doesn't matter if it's white, black, or Hispanic. It doesn't matter if it's middle income or low income. Everybody wants more policing. The challenge for us is that you know, we live in a society in which the same communities most disadvantaged and most afflicted by high rates of violence are the same communities who, for a variety of social and historical reasons, have some distrust of the police, or certainly a level of trust that's less than that of other folks. And that's a constant effort for us. And as we engage with the community and do our best to, you know, police it ethically and appropriately, we're held hostage to a critical incident anywhere in the United States. You know, unlike any other industry, you know, if one of our members in the broad, you know, outline of 900,000 police officers in this country, if any of them misbehaves on camera, the entire profession is held accountable. That's a tough place to be in. It's a tough place to be in as an administrator, but it's a really tough place to be as a young idealistic officer working a tough beat, knowing that that everything you do is going to be judged in light of the worst documented performance that's made its way to the national airways.
Well, getting back to videotaping of police encounters, one of those cases elsewhere in the country that you were just talking about was the case of Eric Garner in New York, died in a chokehold, caught on camera. And critics of the idea of cameras have said, hey, we had this video. There's no indictment. Cameras aren't going to change accountability. So do you think this is going to answer any of the questions that the public hopes are answered with the use of body cameras?
Well, there seems to be, you know, an unfortunate narrative out there that if a police officer acts outside of policy and there's a bad outcome, he must go to jail. Okay? We don't hold anybody to that standard, including the military when they accidentally blow up the wrong village in Afghanistan. If you do something inadvertent or wrong or outside of policy, but you're not motivated by malice or ill will or prejudice, the appropriate sanction is strong discipline up to and including firing. Or in the military, a court-martial and the end of your career. But the notion that the only form of accountability for sworn law enforcement officers when they err, as opposed to do wrong, is to indict them and put them in prison. I think that's a false construct. It's a destructive construct. And it's really, you know, unworthy of the kind of people we try to draw to this profession who should not have to worry about. They have to make, you know, the essence of this job is making critical decisions under pressure with insufficient information and ambiguous circumstances. All right? You got to make a decision right now. And sometimes it's going to be the wrong decision. And if we can show that it's the wrong decision and outside of policy, I mean, I have fired people for bad decisions, you know, with tragic consequences. but it doesn't mean it was appropriate to put them in jail when their intent wasn't evil. And that's, I think, an important distinction to make when we're talking about accountability. It's up to police chiefs and their supervising authorities to hold people accountable for error that has tragic consequences. And I don't think it's necessary that that has to go to the criminal justice system.
We'll leave it there. Chief Flynn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
That was Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn talking about Mayor Tom Barrett's proposal to equip all beat cops with body cameras in Milwaukee by the end of next year. That budget proposal will go before the Common Council on Monday. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
As baby boomers age, they and their families are trying to figure out how and where they'll be living in the future and what kind of care they'll need. Our next guest writes that in many states, changes in Medicaid funding are making it easier for people to stay out of institutional settings like nursing homes, but there are a lot of obstacles to making that a reality.
Wisconsin has programs in place to use Medicaid funding for some kinds of assistance, but those programs are in flux now after changes in the new state budget. A new plan for the state's IRIS program is in the midst of public hearings, and the next ones are scheduled Monday in Hayward and Wausau and Wednesday in Madison.
Our next guest wrote a piece on the Next Avenue website. It's titled, Will We Really Be Able to Age in Place? Beth Baker is the author of With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older. She blogs about aging in community for Next Avenue. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, has this been a general move, a trend over the years, trying to encourage people to age at home when possible as opposed to those institutional settings?
Well, that is a trend, but I would say it's driven not by trying to convince people, but because it's a grassroots movement almost, that people are looking around at their options. They're seeing in the past what there's been is regular traditional retirement communities, maybe moving in with your kids if you're lucky enough that they want you, or what most of us choose to do is stay put in our own homes. And there's a lot of drawbacks, it turns out, to that as far as loneliness, isolation, marginalization. And that's what interests me. What at the grassroots can we do to leave ourselves in a much healthier, happier position as we grow older?
I want to get into those obstacles and solutions to them. But first, if it's done right, what are the benefits? Why are people wanting to stay at home if possible, as opposed to, say, a nursing home?
There's two main benefits that I think drive this. On the one hand, especially in our culture, there's a very strong desire to be independent, autonomous, make our own decisions. None of us want to be governed by other people's rules, and most of these institutions have a lot of rules. The other reason is that people are starting to become more aware of the role that social support has, not only in making us happier, as one would expect, but even healthier. So it turns out the research is finding that extreme loneliness and isolation affects our bodies, not just our moods. So it affects our immune system, our blood pressure, all sorts of things. So there are many reasons why living at home around people who care about you, whether it's your neighbors, your friends, church members, family, is a lot better for us, not to mention the economic benefits for our society.
Well, let's talk about the reality of trying to make that happen. What kinds of support needs, whoever provides it, we'll get into that in a bit, but what kind of support are people finding that they need as they stay at home, maybe longer than they used to?
It kind of comes in waves, or even more of a zigzag is probably a more accurate way to look at it. It can start with something like your home doesn't work for you anymore, like all of a sudden steps are a problem. You're a fall risk, which is what happened to my own mother. The next thing that may well happen is you live, say, in the suburbs where you were always dependent on a car, and all of a sudden it's not such a great idea for you to drive, yet there's nowhere easy for you to walk for, in many of our communities. Then there's an increasing layer, maybe, of help that you might need. Maybe you can't see as well. Maybe you can't hear as well. Maybe you can't walk as well. And the more, and not this doesn't affect everybody, of course. Each, it's a very individual thing. So the help, therefore, also has to be very individual, and people have to have almost like a menu of services that they can draw upon in order to stay home in a safe and happy way.
I'm talking to Beth Baker about aging in place, staying at home as long as we can, or on our own in an independent setting as long as we can. She wrote a piece titled, Will We Really Be Able to Age in Place? So that help, Beth, that people are going to need, is it out there? Is it available to us? And if not, how big a shortfall do we have?
Well, we have a huge shortfall, to answer that part of the question. Part of the reason, and it's something I try to push against, is there's so much denial in our culture about aging. So I'm really trying to encourage folks to not be in denial and see how, if they take charge of their future, they'll be in much better shape. In some communities, I would say, for example, Portland, Oregon, they've been very proactive on many fronts of making people's lives whole as they grow old at home. So there's transportation options, there's elder-friendly business certification, there's all kinds of volunteer groups. And volunteer groups and simply friendships are key to what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a whole new big government program. That's not going to happen. And I've become convinced, although I'm not somebody who's against government programs generally, that it's better on many levels if we do this as a grassroots level. It's more empowering for those of us who are doing it, and you can rely more on folks you already know instead of some bureaucracy, some strangers.
And that takes me to an issue you've written a lot about, a little bit in this piece, but also in your book and other pieces you've written. People planning their older years to be in an intentional community, to be near people that they know and can help out and share volunteer resources with and just be a community of seniors.
Yes, and that can happen in our own multi-generational neighborhoods that we've lived in for a long time, or it can happen by moving to an intentional, say, senior co-housing community. That's where people build a community from the ground up and each have their own little household, but may have a large common dining room so they can eat together once a week. It can take many forms, and I believe there's a form out there for everybody, but the most determined hermit.
Well, suppose somebody's in that situation now, they're getting older, or a parent is getting older. How do they start taking steps toward being in that kind of community? Because this is a new idea, I think, to a lot of people.
Yes, and the earlier you start, of course, the better off you'll be. I like to look at my own neighborhood, which I'm lucky enough to live in a close-knit neighborhood. But for several years now, we've been having just fun picnics, all kinds of potlucks together, hanging out together, all ages, and then there's subgroups. Sometimes it's just the older folks, and sometimes it's just the people with little kids. But through that, we found a kind of organic way of helping each other out. So I work at home. If a kid gets locked out of their house, they know they can knock on my door and I'll help them. Well, over time, as we're getting, some of us are getting older, that's feeding into helping each other with, say, going to doctor's appointments if we're having a hard time driving. And it's happening in a very natural way. So I think the older people feel a little more willing to ask for help, which is one of the big challenges. People don't want to admit that they need help. But if you are already quite elderly and you don't have a community like this, it's going to be hard to begin. And that's where something like the Village Movement comes in. I don't know if you're familiar with villages. There is one in Madison, I noticed. But this is a Neighbors Helping Neighbors membership organization. And it's being formed all around the United States to assist people stay independent as long as they possibly can by calling on their neighbors for all sorts of support, non-medical support, I might add.
Talk about how that would work. I'm not familiar with that organization here in Wisconsin.
It's formed normally by a committed core of just a few people, and they get their neighbors to sign up, and they pay membership dues. It can range anywhere from $50 a year to $900 a year, depending on where you live and how much paid help the village wants to hire. So if you want to make it all volunteer, it can be very cheap. They often run more efficiently if you have at least one paid person. It's a one-stop call. So you call one central number for your village, and you say, you know, I really need a house sitter tomorrow because I have to be out, or I really want to go to the theater, but I don't drive at night anymore. It can be anything. There's also some funny examples in my book where a lady found out her cat had to be on Metamucil, and she didn't want to go buy a whole jar of Metamucil, and she called the village to give her some, and they found somebody who would do that. A 100-year-old lady had a hankering for pizza. Couldn't order a whole one. That would be wasteful. She called the village. They ordered a pizza and shared it with her. It can be anything.
We're talking to Beth Baker about her piece on Next Avenue titled, Will We Really Be Able to Age in Place? You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234.
Are you dealing with this question right now for you or for your parents? Are you making an effort to age at home, outside of a nursing home or other facility? What's working and what challenges are you facing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Beth Baker. We're looking at aging in the United States and efforts to help more people grow old in their own homes in independent circumstances outside of institutional settings like nursing homes.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this a conversation you're having now in your family for you or maybe an aging relative? What kind of help have you found out there? What kind of help do you need to age in place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Willie is on the line in Green Bay. Willie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 79-year-old World War a Vietnam veteran. And I'm a double amputee. And so I'm fortunate to have a lovely wife of 53 years, and she's a nurse. So she helps me a great deal at home.
And do you have other help, Willie? Can I ask, is this all on your wife, or is there other support out there for you?
Well, there would be because she has so many friends in the nursing area. She does a lot of volunteer work at several hospitals in town, and she also does help out other people who are worse off than I am. So I'm still able to get around. I have a wheelchair that I can actually get into my van going up a ramp so I can get around. I passed my driver's test, and which I thought was pretty good.
Not bad. Willie, thank you so much. Good luck to you. Willie gets a lot of support from his wife and her nursing network. Family, I want to talk about that a little, Beth. You wrote in your piece, I think, that family isn't necessarily the resource it used to be for people aging.
Well, it won't be just demographically. The percentage or portion of family caregivers per elder is shrinking. That's just a fact. Still, families give far and away the most support than any sector of our society. I wanted to also mention, since Will is a veteran, about a really cool model that the VA has initiated called medical foster homes, so that if you didn't have a lovely wife who is a nurse and you were single, say, and you were a veteran who was quite disabled, you move in with another family. They're trained to support you as best they can, and they're connected through telehealth to a nurse, a VA nurse. So if they have questions about your care, they can get on a screen with the nurse. She can look at the person and support the older person living, if not in their own home, at least in somebody else's home. And it's extremely affordable model.
Willie, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Kara in Madison. Kara, hi. Kara, are you there?
Oh, this is Carol.
Carol, go ahead.
Yes, I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and I feel very blessed because I am part of one of the villages that your person is speaking. And the name of that village is SAIL, S-A-I-L, and it's Serving Independent Lives. And its role is both social as well as providing volunteer opportunities where members help each other, as well as providing vetted members. And if you have a problem and you don't know how to solve it, you just call one number and they will figure out a way how to get you help or to get what you need. And I can give you the telephone number of the organization if you would like that.
Go for it, Carol. Sure.
Yes, the telephone number of SAIL is 608-231-4321.
Thanks, Carol. And before we let you go, Carol, do people from outside, like non-seniors, volunteer, provide some of the volunteer help with that organization?
Primarily, it's seniors that provide the care. There are some non-seniors that are volunteers, but it's primarily seniors, some like myself, who are still very able and able to get around and help other people, and we want to pay forward to the time that we may not be so able, and then some other people might be coming up behind us and being willing to volunteer and help us.
Fantastic, Carol. Thank you so much for sharing that. And you mentioned, Beth, that isolation that people feel, this would help fix it in both directions, the people getting help in any instance and the people giving the help who are part of this.
I'm so glad Carol raised that, because another big part of our aging that can be really detrimental is if we don't have a sense of purpose and a sense of belonging. And these villages and similar organizations I write about give people that chance to give back, to have a reason to get out of bed in the morning.
So as we wrap up, Beth, are you optimistic? Do you see things moving in the right direction to get people help they need to age in place?
You know, I often think, I'm 63, I'm really glad that I'm growing old right now and not earlier, because I think there is a blossoming at the grassroots of really creative options. I think we're doing it too slowly, given how rapidly our population's aging, but I'm very optimistic, and I really hope people will give it some thought and look into some of these. My website has links to a lot of these organizations I'm talking about, bethbaker.net, and I hope you will really, all your listeners, will think about it, whether for themselves or for their family members.
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Beth Baker. She's the author of the book, With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older. We've got a link to the piece we've been talking about, this idea of aging in place and what we do and don't have in place to help people do that. Head over. You can find that at the Central Time Facebook page. Beth also blogs, by the way, about aging and community for the website Next Avenue.
It's not just homeowners who are putting up solar energy panels, so are some Wisconsin power companies. A project planned by Alliant Energy near Beloit would be the largest utility-operated solar project in the state, with about 7,500 panels on top of a coal ash landfill. Chuck Kornbach went for a look.
Can't believe how much grass you've gotten, Ken. It's remarkable. Jeffrey Underwood of the South Korea-based Hanwha Corporation is hiking on top of a gently sloping hillside that's covered with grass and weeds. This south-facing site, owned by Alliant Energy in the town of Beloit, may, by next year, hold 20 acres of sun-tracking solar panels. Hanwha is developing the solar installation for Alliant and will sell the utility about 2 megawatts of power for the next decade at least. Underwood says putting solar above a closed coal ash landfill makes perfect sense.
Solar projects in general are an excellent reuse for landfills, Superfund sites, brownfield sites, in that, one, the length of the projects and the long life of these projects in the 20 to 40 year range give the land additional time to settle and cure, but it also just makes it reuse.
Underwood says on firmer terrain, his company would drive piles into the ground to support the foundations for the solar arrays. But he says on this landfill that holds ash from a shut-down coal-fired plant Alliant operated nearby, Hanwha will build or cast concrete footings that will only go into the ground a little ways. He says the panels will still be able to withstand high winds and the weight of snow and ice. Alliant project manager Kim Halverson says building on the coal ash landfill should also help the economics.
We're not taking away habitat, and also we own the site already, so that further reduces the costs. And this project is really about how far can we go with solar for the lowest cost per kilowatt hour.
The hillside is just above the Rock River with a stormwater retention pond between the river and the landfill. Rock County has already extended shoreland zoning for the company. Dennis Mack of the Wisconsin DNR says it appears the solar panels won't make the landfill unstable and that any problems could be easily fixed.
Because it's at the top of the landfill, as opposed to a landfill liner or a leachate collection system that's placed at the bottom of the landfill.
Alliant isn't just developing the 7,600-panel solar farm because it wants to explore the solar market. Under an agreement with the EPA aimed at reducing air pollution, Alliant expanded its efforts with alternative fuels, though the company says the 2-megawatt solar farm exceeds the deal with the Obama administration. These solar panels appear non-controversial, but elsewhere on Alliant's Town of Beloit property, there is a bit of a dispute. This is Alliant's natural gas-fired facility that the company wants to expand. And if the state PSC okays that expansion, Alliant wants to build a second solar farm to help power the natural gas units. Michael Vickerman of the group Renew Wisconsin says making more solar dependent on use of more fossil fuels is not the way other utilities are going.
Our view is that solar can stand alone all by itself. It does not need to be put inside a large central station generating facility. Darrellin Power has issued a solicitation looking for 25 megawatts of standalone solar.
Vickerman says Alliant natural gas expansion in the town of Beloit may not be approved. While that plays out, the company hopes to get started on the solar farm on the coal ash landfill later this year. Chuck Hornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk to Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction about the state of education and possible changes to his position. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.